we are witnessing China's increasing power and access to advanced technologies. This shift in economic power from the West to the East of the world brings changes that can create opportunities for us, although we must pursue them with our eyes wide open. I believe that the most detrimental move you can make is to have implicit trust and focus on the outside. But in the current state of affairs, I believe China will become a new power in the new world order.
China has also been challenging U.S. foreign policy by buying crude oil from Iran and Venezuela, two countries boycotted by the U.S. But the West only has itself to blame, as China and Russia were the first JCPOA parties to recognize the lifting of the arms embargo on Iran based on UNSC Resolution 2231, which endorsed the JCPOA, or Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. This pact was between Iran and the five permanent UN Security Council members plus one. That's the US, UK, France, Russia, China, and Germany.
Of course, this hasn't been a path that would lead to our terminating cooperations with Europe. But the Westerners have made commitments in the JCPOA to pave the way for Iran to enjoy the economic benefits of the deal. But the illegal U.S. withdrawal from the accord and Europe's inaction and negligence didn't allow Iran's trade ties with the West to improve. They've missed this opportunity.
The U.S. also has a new president, Biden, who came in giving the world fresh hope. He could have issued executive orders to lift at least some of the sanctions against Iran the day he took office on 20th January. At least that was Iran's expectation, but he didn't. The U.S. and West at large seem to be under the illusion further pressure will get Iran to concede and appeal to Western powers for relief. But Iran will not stop at anything short of a guarantee from the U.S. and West any longer. Fool me once, fool me twice.
In general, international imperialism will never remove the sanctions, at least not altogether, because it opposes the philosophy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, because they haven't fulfilled their interests and greed in the region and can't see them as long as the Islamic Republic of Iran is in power. This has been made clear. They won't lift the sanctions. There were some positive developments during the golden days of the Obama administration, but as we saw, they reneged on their promises. As the former head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran said, they went back on their word. That's why they can't be trusted.
Referring to U.S. maximum pressure sanctions Iran is still under, Kazem Gharibabadi made a biblical reference. One should not expect that if he slaps someone on the right cheek, that someone would turn the other cheek. The extraterritorial dimensions of U.S. sanctions, which are in contradiction with international law, prevented even the U.S.'s European friends from implementing their commitments. This is when all 15 quarterly reports of the Nuclear Watchdog Director General up to May 2018 and a year after that stated clearly that Iran was in full compliance with the JCPOA. It took a whole year of persistent non-compliance by the U.S. that Iran decided to use its rights under the JCPOA to adopt a policy of partially ceasing implementing its commitments under that deal. Even then, the IAEA, or UN nuclear watchdog, was able to monitor and verify steps Iran was taking in that regard. In the same vein, it was only after about 2.5 years of continued proliferation of U.S. economic sanctions that on the 2nd of December 2020, Iranian Parliament passed the law. The law required the government to stop the implementation of all verification and monitoring activities beyond Iran's safeguards agreement concluded with the IAEA, CSA, and so forth.
After the cowardly assassination of Mr. Fakhrizadeh last year, the parliament passed a law that obliged the government to stop all inspections beyond the safeguards agreement by March 2021. That was a gesture from the Islamic Republic of Iran in the framework of the nuclear deal. But when the Western signatories don't honor their obligations, logic dictates that the other side would also reduce its commitments. But to give diplomacy a chance, considering that the Biden administration had just taken office and had expressed willingness to return to the deal, something we have realized isn't very true, Iran and the IAEA reached a deal.
China is now Iran's first trading partner, and other countries in the Eurasian region have become Iran's new partners who are receiving new attention in our foreign trade. But as long as the other side is not ready to improve the economic and trade situation with Iran, they should not expect Iran to wait for them. There are more than 200 countries in the world, each of which is seen as an opportunity to enhance cooperation. These opportunities in Asia, Iran-China cooperations, and those in the ASEAN and our neighbors used to be potential in the past but have now been actualized.
All efforts and concessions, however, haven't stirred much Western action. Hence, Iran's veering away from the West to include more of the East for the long haul and easing tensions with other regional players, such as Saudi Arabia. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do return to the box at the same times next week and each week after, as you never know what's on. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Muhammad Al-Hindi learned the terrible news on Facebook. His fiancée, Hadil Arafah, had been killed in an Israeli regime airstrike. The incident in which Hadil, 28, was killed occurred on May 12th. The Zionist regime fired a missile at her home in Khan Yunis area of Gaza that afternoon. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Khalud Rabah Suleiman, journalist. This article is published under the heading Zionist Regime Wrecks Wedding Dreams. Stay tuned for more. Muhammad Al-Hindi learned the terrible news on Facebook. His fiancée, Hadil Arafah, had been killed in an Israeli regime airstrike. At first, Muhammad did not believe what he had read. It was only when he got a phone call from Hadil's brother that he accepted it was true. Muhammad was so shocked that he could not speak. He went into a room and wept quietly. The incident in which Hadil, 28, was killed occurred on May 12. The Zionist regime fired a missile at her home in Khan Yunis area of Gaza that afternoon. Hadil's mother was also killed. Muhammad and Hadil had planned to marry on May 16th. Yet, they had to postpone the wedding as the Israeli regime launched a major attack on Gaza that month. They did not know when they postponed it that Hadil would be a victim of that attack. Muhammad said, "I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her, but she was killed in cold blood before we could get married." Several days after his fiancée was killed, another disaster befell Muhammad. His family's home was also hit in an Israeli regime airstrike. The damage caused to the building was immense. An apartment which Muhammad had built and where he planned to live with Hadil was destroyed. Muhammad was a shop worker earning low wages. He had to borrow money so that he could build and furnish the apartment. As he has not yet repaid the debts he incurred while building the apartment, Muhammad is not sure how he can raise the money needed to rebuild it. "The Israeli regime occupation has destroyed me," he said. "I have nothing now, no apartment and no wife. I just wish Hadil was here so that she could ease my pain." Waleed al-Bitar and Maisa Abu al-Auf had also set a date for their wedding. It was supposed to take place on July 25th. Much of the preparations for the ceremony had already been carried out. Maisa had bought her dress, makeup, and jewelry. The plans were ruined on May 16th. That was the day when the Zionist regime perpetrated a massacre on Al-Wahda Street in Gaza City, where Abu al-Auf family lived. Two of Maisa's sisters, Shaima and Rawan, were among the many people from their extended family killed in that attack. Their mother, Dina al-Yazigi, later died from her wounds. Maisa had actually gone shopping for her wedding dress with Shaima, who was also engaged, and their mother. That dress was found under the rubble of the family's home following the massacre. Maisa broke down in tears when she saw how the dress was destroyed. In keeping with local traditions, Waleed had given a bride price worth approximately $7,000 to Maisa. It had been used to buy the dress and other items for the wedding. The couple is conscious that things could have been even worse. Waleed regards it as fortunate that Maisa herself survived the horrors. Waleed said, "I cannot imagine life without Maisa. She is the air I breathe." According to Waleed, the wedding will still go ahead at some future date. "Maisa and I will not let the Israeli regime occupation steal the joy we will feel when we are married," he said. "We will have a big wedding when the situation for Maisa's family gets better." The Zionist regime's May attack may not have been presented as a war against weddings, but it had serious consequences for the planning of numerous marriage ceremonies. Among the many businesses damaged or destroyed during the attack was one which specialized in selling wedding outfits. While its May attack was underway, the Zionist regime forbade the entry of building materials into Gaza. The ban has been in place for most of the time since then. It was not until late August that the Israeli regime allowed such items as cement, gravel, and steel bars to be imported by private companies in Gaza. Muhammad al-Rais is engaged, yet he and his fiancée have not finalized a wedding date. Al-Rais is building an apartment for them to live in. He began doing so in February, yet his work was interrupted by the May attack. Soon after that attack ended, Al-Rais tried to find cement, gravel, and some other items. Amid the Israeli regime's entry ban, prices of construction materials had doubled. Al-Rais could not afford to buy what he needed. He works in a marketing firm, and his wages are only $300 per month. He and his fiancée had been thinking about getting married in September this year. That plan did not materialize. The idea of initially living with his fiancée family after the wedding had been broached, but her family made it clear that they wished for Al-Rais to complete the apartment before they got married. He said, "The situation here does not make us sense. We should not have to stop building just because the Israeli regime occupation controls the crossings into Gaza. These are not luxury materials. They are essential. We cannot live without them."
We get people.
U.S. deportation of Haitians.
The U.S. government has deported thousands of Haitian refugee seekers back to their crisis-hit country. The United States' inhumane treatment of Haitian asylum seekers and migrants involves policies designed to deter specific nationality from entering the country put in place decades earlier. Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Danny Arya. In this episode, we will investigate the U.S. government's hatred towards Haitians, which is part and parcel of the anti-migrant and xenophobic strategy culminating at the southern border with Mexico, where for years, thousands of refugee seekers have been stranded before being sent away. Thank you for joining us.
There is not enough food to give to everybody who's inside there. We need to get out of the camp to look for food. Things are worse.
It is these pictures of border patrol agents on horseback pushing migrants into the river that have caused so much anger. For some, they carry the echoes of the worst chapters of American history.
What we witness takes us back hundreds of years. What we witness was worse than what we witnessed in slavery. Cowboys with their reins again whipping black people, Haitians, into the water.
The recent mass migration of Haitians was in part caused by a magnitude 7.2 earthquake, as well as tropical storms that affected the entire impoverished nation. The July assassination of President Jovenel Moïse further exacerbated violence and instability in the Caribbean country.
Disregarding the human suffering, the Biden administration has already deported thousands of migrants, according to official estimates. Now that comes on top of the thousands of others deported in previous administrations, including the 12,000 Haitian migrants indefinitely detained in Guantanamo in the 1990s. We're now joined by Dr. Adrienne Pine, a professor of anthropology at American University. She's also an author, and her latest book is titled Asylum for Sale, Profit and Protest in the Migration Industry. Thank you for joining us, Professor.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, ma'am, first of all, what is the fact that the U.S. is deporting Haitian refugee seekers back say about Washington's claims of promoting human rights across the globe?
You know, it's particularly ironic that there's talk of sending Haitians to Guantanamo Bay, which, of course, Haitians were kept at an offshore, really concentration camp in Guantanamo Bay in the early 1990s during the crisis following the U.S.'s support of the ousting, the coup against Aristide in Haiti. And but what's ironic is this is, Guantanamo is in Cuba. It's land that the United States has not returned to the nation of Cuba, and it's a site where the worst human rights violations that one can imagine are carried out. And meanwhile, the United States has been hemming and hawing about the supposed violations of human rights that Cuba is committing. And it's just, it really is mind-boggling to think that the United States claims itself to be a promoter of human rights and is punishing other countries and is issuing sanctions against other countries that are starving their populations and, you know, harming their health in the middle of a pandemic, when in fact the United States is doing things that are far, far worse. This represents a huge threat to the people of Haiti, which is, you know, really sort of piling on top of so many other insults and injuries that the United States has committed through coups, through acts of violence, and against Haitians in Haiti, and now by violating international refugee law by preventing Haitians, denying them their right to seek asylum in the country they choose. It's really, really outrageous.
Thank you, ma'am. Professor Adrian Pine there joining us.
The United States' brutal deportation of Haitian migrants and refugee seekers is wreaking havoc not just among human rights advocates, but also within the American public. President Biden won the Democratic nominee as well as the presidential election by claims of supporting human rights and promoting liberal values.
Yet the mass deportation effort is laying bare the depth of U.S. disregard for those claims under his administration. Refugee and asylum seekers often embark on a lengthy journey to get to America. Many recount being kidnapped several times and released only after paying drug cartels a hefty ransom. To get a better perspective, we've also invited Mr. Kim Ives, an independent filmmaker and commentator. He's also editor at Haiti Liberté. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Ives, given profound instability in the Caribbean nation, how do you think the fate of the refugee seekers is going to pan out?
Well, they appear to be letting some refugees come into the U.S. to try to blunt the outcry, both national and international, against the treatment the Haitians have been receiving. But they are still sending flights. These past few days, they have been sending 4 or 5 flights a day of Haitians back to Haiti. But this may end up being a huge miscalculation on this part, because right now there is a revolution brewing in Haiti. Haiti's huge underclass, the lumpen proletariat of Haiti, is being forged into a force of resistance right now by an alliance of armed neighborhood groups who the bourgeoisie of Haiti used to give guns to settle their scores and fight their political battles.
Thank you for joining us, Mr. Kim Ives, here on We the People.
Corrupted authorities and criminals extort migrants every chance they get in countries on the way, such as Mexico. Many officials, cartels, and criminals are making a fortune by exploiting those seeking a better chance to live.
Nosotros los haitianos que viajan a pie, que coge todo lo lucha para llegar aquí, que gasta muchos dineros y ellos llegan aquí. Nosotros se piden al gobierno que se apoyamos a nosotros, que dan papeles, porque algunos de nosotros, si encuentran papeles, puede empezar a trabajar, puede ganar plata, puede ganar una vida mejor. Después ellos pueden pensar a ir a otro país. Pero como ellos no tienen ni papeles, no nada, ellos querían viajar.
There are still continuous reports of illegal crossings, detentions, and even murder and sexual abuse in regards to the migrants. Many of the migrants intend to join their loved ones on the other side of the border through Texas's Rio Grande Valley, the busiest corridor for illegal crossings. What is the difference in the way this administration handles immigration compared to the previous one?
The Biden administration is continuing the Trump administration policies, not only with respect to Haiti, and I could say all of Latin America, where it's keeping in place the sanctions against Haiti's neighbor Cuba, where it's keeping in place the war on Venezuela, where it's keeping in place the backing, or kept in place the backing of President Jovenel Moïse up until his assassination. So on the border, it's the same thing. They are continuing, as I mentioned earlier, the metering, the Title 42, the keeping people at bay, and the verbiage of making things more humane and more, what's the word I'm looking for, and more more humane is all that they've stepped up. But as for the actual policies, no. They're essentially the same as the Trump administration policies.
The exclusionary policy against migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers, particularly those from Haiti, has a long history, and the Biden administration's course is just a continuation of brutal U.S. strategy. Today, Haitians are being whipped away from U.S. borders, reviving images of black people being whipped in cotton fields by white men on horseback.
The images coming out of encampment along the Del Rio International Bridge in Texas are not only heartbreaking, but also a telltale of how much Washington cares about human rights and suffering. The U.S., meanwhile, employs the human rights excuse mostly to intervene in the internal affairs of other nations.
You know, the refugees who are currently being deported in violation of their international right to seek asylum using Title 42, which is a racist policy implemented by Trump's advisor, Stephen Miller, that the Biden administration has decided to continue using. Under that, these deportations, the Haitians who are being deported to Haiti are really going to be facing dire circumstances. A large number of them have actually been out of the country for around a decade since the 2010 earthquake in Haiti that, you know, as we know, killed hundreds of thousands of people. People fled. They went all over the Americas, large community in Brazil, in Peru. And many of those Haitians have residency in those countries. They actually have lives that they could go back to and that wouldn't be necessarily, you know, not what they're seeking, as they are seeking to come to the United States, but they would be better than what they face in Haiti, which is a country that is politically and, you know, really otherwise infrastructurally devastated.
Now, whether Haitians are entering through the southern border or trying to get to Florida's shores by boat, what is clear is that the Biden administration does not intend on helping Haitians who are themselves victims of U.S. policies in Central America and the Caribbean. While President Biden needs to be held accountable, the administration has to respond why.
Well, the former special envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, essentially said that he didn't have a voice in this administration. He said that he was ignored. He also said he didn't want to be connected to what he saw as cruel and inhumane policies. He said that it was wrong to be deporting Haitians back to Haiti because that island nation is facing a number of crises, including the aftermath and political turmoil of the assassination of the president, as well as an earthquake that hit the country last week. I want to read part of Daniel Foote's letter because it was a blistering letter. It said in part, "I will not be associated with the United States' inhumane, counterproductive decision to deport thousands of Haitian refugees. The collapsed state," and he's referring to Haiti, "is unable to provide security or basic services, or more refugees will fuel further desperation and crime." So there he is saying that Haiti is actually being harmed by us sending back, the United States sending back Haitian migrants.
The so-called illegal aliens are desperate human beings escaping violence, poverty, and mafia. They had left Haiti in the hopes of fleeing persecution or seeking a better life. Yet now they face an uncertain future, hanging somewhere in the middle of a game played by the most powerful men in America.
The U.S. Special Envoy, Daniel Foote, has resigned in a blistering letter that he sent to the State Department, saying it was inhumane what they were doing, and basically decried the U.S. policy of sending people back into Haiti when it is in complete crisis following the July 7th assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. the August 14th earthquake, the August 16th tropical storm, the country is totally reeling underneath economic and financial crisis. And so sending these people back is just the height of cruelty. And at the same time, the U.S. is receiving 95,000 Afghan refugees. Why can't it receive a few Haitian refugees and asylum seekers as well?
The U.S. policies towards migrants has also created a crisis for Mexico. Mexico's border cities are not equipped to house, feed, and protect tens of thousands of refugees. Many of the cases of migrants forced to remain in Mexico ended with deportation orders from judges because they failed to show up for their immigration court hearing on the U.S. side of the border.
Immigration has always been essential to America. Let's end our exhausting war over immigration. For more than 30 years, politicians have talked about immigration reform, and we've done nothing about it. It's time to fix it. On day one of my presidency, I kept my commitment and sent a comprehensive immigration bill to the United States Congress. If you believe we need to secure the border, pass it because it has a lot of money for high-tech border security. If you believe in a pathway to citizenship, pass it. It's over 11 million undocumented folks, the vast majority of here overstaying visas. Pass it. We can actually, if you actually want to solve a problem.
Despite all the baseless promises, the immigrants have had to stay in places such as the Mexican state of Tamaulipas. In such places, rape, torture, and kidnapping are so pervasive that the U.S. State Department itself has a do not travel advisory on.
Making a calculus here, he's thinking about which American publics matter more. It really has to do with internal politics. There is a large number of people in the United States who are very anti-migration and very anti-migrant, and he's trying to appear tough on crime, whatever the cost, including the cost being the lives of and well-being of Haitian asylum seekers. And, you know, then there are, of course, large numbers of people who care about human rights. And, you know, I think the problem is that that human rights aren't negotiable. This should not be a domestic political issue, which is really what it is. Biden is just sort of following the electoral winds and thinking, you know, that that, you know, the Democratic Party might lose in the next elections in Miami or Texas because they're letting in all of these, you know, Haitian immigrants. But that's not the issue here. I mean, you know, I believe that regardless of what the, you know, what the majority of the American people think, and I actually don't know how that would break down. It would depend on how you'd ask the question, but I think we do believe ourselves to be a nation that respects human rights.
Now the Haitian migrants, they take on a deeply harrowing journey in brutal temperatures of up to 40 degrees centigrade. While in Mexico, many of the asylum seekers are targeted by criminal gangs and drug cartels. Many children are sexually abused or employed for dangerous crimes. The dire conditions of the Haitian migrants are definitely going to worsen as they are deported away from the U.S. amid silence by many politicians and top U.S. decision makers.
As many as 80% of migrants have been victimized, according to reports by human rights organizations. Emboldened by U.S. anti-migration attitude, bandits, a violent drug, and people smuggling gangs find no reason to show mercy to the victims.
Well, I think the world has been witnessing one of the great human rights travesties this past weeks as the situation at the border continues to worsen. Already, we know that the Biden administration has kept wholesale most of the Trump administration's policies, such as metering. This is where they have to, where immigrants can't come into the U.S. to ask asylum. They have to wait in another country, like Mexico, usually in squalid camps, and get a number and wait for their number to arrive, which can be months, even years.
The embarrassing treatment of Haitians today comes in the backdrop of at least 4 years of Republican zero-tolerance agenda to block the southern border in order to make it more difficult for the migrants to enter the United States. Former President Trump was notorious in his anti-migrant and xenophobic policies, which he kept promoting with backing from the GOP base.
We will build a great wall along the southern border, and Mexico will pay for the wall. On day one, we will begin working on an impenetrable, physical, tall, powerful, beautiful southern border wall. After meeting with their wonderful, wonderful president today, I really believe they want to solve this problem along with us, and I'm sure they will.
With a Democratic government in power in the White House, many rights activists expected the situation to change, but to no avail. The massive crackdown on migration puts on display the core ideologies in Washington in favor of cracking down on victims arriving at U.S. borders rather than helping them. The Trump administration was notorious for exercising zero tolerance at the U.S. border with Mexico. So, what is the difference between the Trump administration and the current one in terms of dealing with migration at the southern border?
You know, we're really seeing very little difference at all. And this is not surprising to those of us who know Biden's history. He, in fact, as vice president to Obama, they really started up the incarceration, the levels of immigrant detention that we're seeing now. And that hasn't been reduced. But more importantly, as I mentioned, Title 42, which is an explicitly racist, xenophobic policy that was really floated by Stephen Miller even before the pandemic. Stephen Miller being the racist advisor to President Trump, it was floated as a way to prevent brown and black people from coming into the United States. The pandemic gave them the perfect excuse to say that migrants pose a public health risk.
Please stay tuned for more.
Denying migrants a chance to seek asylum is indeed at the heart of America's policies. This is while many of the victims find themselves under these conditions due to decades of U.S. intervention in countries such as Haiti, as well as others in Central and Southern America. With images of Haitians' expulsion going viral, politicians from both sides of the aisle are taking the chance to take advantage of the heated power play over immigration.
It is essentially broken down along the lines that we've seen in recent years with the election of Donald Trump. We have an extremely xenophobic and reactionary part of the American population, which sees immigrants or has swallowed the lie that immigrants are the cause of their misfortune and their growing poverty and their growing lack of services. And yet there is, I could say, a growing percentage of the population, which is not only black or brown or engaged on a level that has them understand these dynamics, but they are, in fact, in solidarity and understand that the plight of immigrants from Haiti and from the rest of Latin America, for that matter, is the same as their own. So I think there has been an outpouring of outrage and solidarity and indignation at what they're seeing happening on the border. The pictures, again, of the border agents on their horses, just like in the days of slavery, two centuries, a century and a half ago, it has recalled these images, and people are saying, enough is enough. We cannot treat people like this.
Now, Republicans say that Joe Biden was the one who led Haitians to believe that they could seek asylum in America, as Democrats express outrage. Fate of the victims, meanwhile, matters to no one. Here at We the People, we wish all migrants well, no matter where they are, and pray for their safety and well-being. Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Make sure you join us next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we started the explanation of Surah Qaf, the 50th surah in order of compilation of the Noble Quran, and today we continue from where we left you. Here are ayahs 9, 10, and 11.
وَنَزَّلْنَا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً مُبَارَكًا فَأَنْبَتْنَا بِهِ جَنَّاتٍ وَحَبَّ الْحَصِيدِ وَالنَّخْلَ بَاسِقَاتٍ لَهَا طَلْعٌ نَضِيدٌ رزقا للعباد وأحيينا به بلدة ميتا كذلك الخروج.
And we sent down from the sky salubrious water, with which we grew gardens and the grain which is harvested, and tall date palms with regularly ranged clusters, as a provision for servants. And with it, we revive a dead country. Likewise, will be the rising from the dead. If you might recall, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of Surah Qaf that speak of God's infinite power, saying that the disbelievers ought to look at the sky above and the earth in order to perceive the reality of resurrection, the earth, the sky, the planets, and the entire universe are undeniable proofs of the power and glory of God, who makes the whole universe function on an orderly basis. The ayahs that we recited to you refer to rainfall and the resurgence of vegetation after losing its greenery during winter, in order to make us realize the reality of resurrection of the dead. Rain is a natural phenomenon, but it depends on divine will. It rejuvenates the earth, provides it with blessings, including growth of plants, delicacy of the air, and flowing of streams. Rainfall and growth of plants are mentioned to illustrate the day of resurrection. Ayah 10 mentions tall date palms with arranged clusters that indicate the bearing of fruits, which is indeed the most joyous moments for farmers as the crop ripens for harvest. The next ayah means to say that this natural process provides sustenance to the creatures, and thus the revival of vegetation in a seemingly dead land is another example of the Almighty's power in resurrection of the dead on the Day of Judgment. In other words, the rising of humans from their graves will be like the revival of plants. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, rain is a great blessing as it revives the seemingly dead plants and makes greenery reappear. Number two, date palm and fruits are of special significance among trees and plants. Hence, God has specifically mentioned it. Number three, plants and trees are the source of freshness, greenery, and beauty, in addition to being means of sustenance and a sign of revival after death. Facts that ought to arouse human conscience regarding God's power to revive the dead human beings to life. Now let us listen to ayahs 12, 13, and 14 of the same surah.
كذبت قبلهم قوم نوح وأصحاب الرس وثمود وعاد وفرعون وإخوان لوط وأصحاب الأيكة وقوم تبع كل كذب الرسل فحق وعيد.
The people of Noah denied truth before them, and so did the inhabitants of Ras and Thamud, and Ad, Pharaoh, and the brethren of Lot, and the inhabitants of Vaikar, and the people of Tobah. Each of them belied the prophets, and so my threat became due against them. These ayahs remind the prophet and the believers of the prophets of the past and the fate suffered by the people to whom they were sent, but faced persecution and denial of divine message. Thus, here God Almighty consoles his last and greatest messenger, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The ayah means to say that if the pagan Arabs hurt you and belie you, do not feel sad, because this is the habit of the disbelievers from the beginning. In addition, these ayahs are a warning to the disbelievers of the fate and torments reserved for them if they continue to mock at the prophets of God. The account of the great flood that drowned the wicked people of the days of Prophet Noah is known to all. As for the inhabitants of Ras, it is said this tribe lived in Yamama in Arabia, and it threw Prophet Hanzalah into a well after denying his call to desist from their unnatural and abominable sexual ways. According to the Prophet of Islam's 16th infallible heir, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, The reason behind the divine torment inflicted upon the inhabitants of Ras was that the women contented themselves with women, that is, they were lesbians. Thamud was a tribe in northwestern Arabia for whose guidance God had sent Prophet Saleh, whom they mocked and mercilessly killed. The she-camel, which was among the divine signs. Ad was a tribe in southern Arabia to whom Prophet Hud was sent, whose efforts to guide them toward God yielded no result, and as a result of their disbelief and wickedness, they were inflicted with divine wrath. Pharaoh was the tyrannical king of Egypt who denied Prophet Moses' call to the right path and was subsequently drowned along with his troops. Prophet Lot was a relative of Prophet Abraham and was accompanied by God to guide the erring people of Sodom, who were destroyed for indulging in the unnatural practice of homosexuality, hence the word Sodomite for such persons. The inhabitants of Aika is reference to the forested area around the Gulf of Aqaba, spanning parts of northern Arabia, Jordan, and the Sinai Peninsula, where the people used to worship a tall tree. They refused to heed the call of Prophet Shu'aib to return to monotheism and desist from their dishonest ways of shortchange and cheating, and as a result were destroyed. Toba was the title of kings of the Yemen. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the all-merciful Creator has raised prophets throughout history in every place and nation to guide human beings to the straight and unwavering path that leads to paradise and to save them from the satanic ways of atheism, polytheism, and all sorts of disbelief and deviation that end up in hell. Number two, since mankind is the best of creation, endowed with the power of intellect and speech, we have to use our God-given brains to choose the right path and save ourselves from divine wrath. And number three, many of the nations of the past committed abominable sins, belied the Prophet, and were afflicted with divine wrath. And therefore, these ayahs are an admonishment for all future generations. Now, let's listen to Ayah 15 as the concluding Ayah of this episode.
أَفَعَيْنَا بِالْخَلْقِ الْأَوَّلِ بَلْ هُمْ فِي لَبْسٍ مِّنْ خَلْقٍ جَدِيدٍ.
Were we exhausted by the first creation? Rather, they are in doubt about a new creation. This ayah refers to the irrationality of the disbelievers and polytheists, many of whom, though acknowledging God as the creator of the universe, are unable to fully comprehend the infinite power of the Lord Most High. Disbelievers may not produce any argument for substantiating their denial of resurrection, but they merely entertain doubts. In other words, this ayah asks these believers whether they imagine that God Almighty is tired of the first creation and he is unable to create anew. These believers are mistaken about divine omnipotence to create anew, since they are unable to produce any argument for substantiating their denial of resurrection and merely entertain doubts. Thus, this ayah means to say, were we unable to create you in the first place? So, why are you in doubt about our ability for recreating you in your original form and shape after death has turned your bodies into dust? We'll learn these points from this ayah. Number one, the doubts of the disbelievers about God's power to revive the dead on the day of resurrection have no basis, because the one who has created a being from naught can surely do it again. Number two, we should apply the cross-questioning method in our discourse with the deniers of truth in order to awaken their minds to the ultimate truth. And number three, the deniers of the day of resurrection have no logic and only insist on their doubts.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavet, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns. Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages